Welcome to the Cigar Lounge, the official podcast of the Cigar Peg, where you get to know your friends a little better, learn a little bit more about each other, and grow as a community. And today we welcome into the Cigar Lounge, Susan Fitzell. Hey, Susan, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Joe. Hey, I'm here with you, and we're going to have a great conversation.
We are. And you know, Susan, I figured that as we do this, I have to start with a confession for everybody, which is I'm admitting this is the second time Susan and I have done a podcast because Joe lost the original recording a year ago. So, Susan, we're going to do this again.
Okay. It'll be totally different.
Yeah, because neither of us remember what we did.
Nope.
So, would you start off, please give everybody an idea of what is it you do and what is it you share with the world?
Oh, goodness. I hate elevator speeches.
No, we're not going to do an elevator speech.
Yeah, I know. So what do? I validate how people learn. I help people, teachers, educators, managers, companies, understand that not everybody learns the same way. I define that in the terms that are out there for such things, such as in schools, it would be helping teachers work with students who have learning disabilities and help them collaborate with each other. And in corporations, helping managers work with employees that are what we call neurodivergent, or basically different brain wiring. You might also call them odd ducks. You know, those people in the office that you go, that's different. So I'm the one who kind of helps management understand what that's all about and how to work with that unique divergent thinking in their company and on their teams.
Okay. And I want to say you've been doing this a while.
I've been in this field for over 40 years.
Okay.
I
know when I first met you, I did an Amazon search and found out you were an entire front page of books.
I have written a lot of books. Yeah. I've written over 16. Now, some of them, they're on their third edition. Three of them, I'm going to be writing the fourth edition soon. I'm updating them, hopefully within the next 6 months, if not sooner. And then I'm working on a new book called, the draft title is in the range of Neurodiversity in the Workplace. It's not the final title yet. That's just the topic, really. It's the topic, it's not the title. However, it's a topic that's not well written about yet. There's not a lot out there. And my take, because of my background, which focuses on how people learn, what motivates people, you know, all those, in some cases, soft skills, emotional IQ, because of all those things, I have a bit of a different approach than a lot of companies are taking on the topic of neurodiversity.
And, you know, I guess as you speak, and you are the educator to the educators.
Yes, I am. Yes.
How did that come about? How did that start? How did you go from educator to educator's educator? Do you remember how that transition happened?
I do. I started out as a teacher a long time ago. I was a classroom teacher, special ed. I was an elementary teacher, high school teacher in special ed, an elementary teacher, just general elementary. And I was also an expert in learning disabilities. And I worked that knowledge for about 16 years in school systems, primarily high schools. Okay. And at some point during that time, the schools started including students with learning disabilities and special needs into the general classroom, which was unheard of at the time. Well, back in the 60s, they called it something like, or 70s, they called it mainstreaming. However, that it really never took off or worked well. And so that was my background. And when schools decided to, or the school I worked in decided to turn the classrooms for general education, certain general education classrooms, into classrooms that included students with learning disabilities. They put two of us in a room. So they'd have a special education teacher and a general education teacher. That was a horrific thing for me. I was totally happy in my own little closet, because most of us teachers with special, who worked with learning disabilities and special ed, always had the worst classrooms, the ones in the building, the one in the corner, the one sometimes in a closet. Yeah. And but I loved teaching. I could shut the door and do what I wanted, and I loved it. And then I was pushed into a teacher's classroom, and actually several teachers' classrooms. They didn't like it. I didn't like it. And so how it all started was I had to figure it out. I had to figure out how to do it. And so I started educating myself and learning strategies to make the relationship with the other teacher work, and to help the students who had never been expected to succeed in those situations in a general classroom, how to help them succeed so they didn't fail. And
as you did this, did you find any mentors or role models that helped you, or did you do it on your own?
I had a couple mentors at the time, although their expertise wasn't in what they call inclusive teaching, or, you know, inclusivity and inclusion is now being used in the corporate space too. Their expertise was more on learning strategies and coaching and how to work. One of them, Mike Mazzacci, was a mentor for me on how to get adults to do things they didn't necessarily want to do or buy into. He was an educator who took a vacuum cleaner sales course over a summer and figured out how to sell vacuum cleaners to people who didn't need them or want them. And then he used those techniques in the classroom and in the boardroom and in, you know, all the work that he did right up to superintendent of schools. And he taught me many of those techniques and skills. And then I had another mentor who was, he'd been a teacher for his original career, and then he became a trainer of teachers. And he was an expert in how people learn and different ways that people learn, different than a lot of schools were teaching. So I put those two things together. And honestly, those are two of the things that I've brought into everything that I do. So I've been successful at helping adults work together that didn't want to work together, whether they were teachers, and now whether they're, you know, team members on a corporate, you know, agile team. And I've also then taken them down the path of how do you deliver information so either students learn or your downline learns. And that's where my learning background comes in. You asked a question, how did it start?
Yeah.
After I figured out how to make it work for me in the classroom, I had this passion to help other teachers not go through the pain I did. So I started developing little workshops so that I could teach teachers how to do what I have learned how to do, so that they didn't have an ulcer like I was getting and have the pain that I had in the classroom.
So you started these workshops. Basically, it was not a goal of going into workshops and speaking. It was just, yeah, I might as well do this and teach people.
Yes, I wanted to help others, not experience this. I started that in 1994.
And how did that grow into the, I want to say, constant on the road trainings that you were doing for a long time? How did that?
Well, a couple things happened. I literally started doing what I'm doing now by sending out, getting mailing lists from the State Department. At one time, you could call or email the DOE, the Department of Education, in any state, and most of them would mail you stickers of every administrator in the state, like little mailing labels.
Yes, yep.
And I made flyers up. I learned how to make flyers. I probably still have one of the books that taught me how to do it. Probably, I made flyers up And I literally folded them at my kitchen table, had my kids help me, and mailed them out. And I set up workshops and I started delivering them. It was real small potatoes and small groups. However, I figured it out. And I was also doing a lot of work back then on bullying prevention. That was something that was very
sort of trendy back then too.
Yes.
Yeah.
And for that, there was, I learned quickly that you had to call something the right thing. So there was a requirement in the state of New Hampshire for every single teacher to get 5 character education hours. So I created a workshop called Character Education Through Conflict Resolution, Self-Confidence, and Respect. And teachers had to take it.
Beautiful.
And if they took it, they got their 5 hours. I made sure it was a 5-hour training and they got their 5 hours. So that's how I started. And then when I got enough experience, I was still teaching full time at that time and raising children and taking martial arts. And I mean, I have my plate full. And then
Wait a minute. I'm going to interrupt because I want to go to that. You said martial arts. I know one of your books has to do with martial arts in the classroom, I guess. Or for teachers, you wrote a book. What's it called? I don't remember.
Oh, Martial Arts and the Awakening of a Public School Teacher.
Yes. What is that about? I just want to know because I saw it somewhere.
So when I was pushed into, or basically many of us were thrown into the general education classroom. So we're walking into, imagine walking into a high school biology class. You're a special education teacher. You're not certified to teach biology, but yet you're there and you're telling that person, yeah, hey, I'm here to help you help the students that are struggling. And they're thinking, I don't even want those students in my classroom. You know, what the heck are you doing here? And how do you expect to help me? You know, do the work I'm doing when you don't know anything about biology. And I did, but that was beside the point. So I started taking martial arts at about the same time and had met an author, Dr. Terrence Webster Doyle, who had written books that were being used in some martial arts classrooms in the country called Why Is Everybody Always Picking on Me? And it was a guide to man at handling bullies. And I read that book and really related to it, met the author. Long story short, incorporated a lot of the philosophy in that book into my work, ended up deciding to, there was a lot of Eastern philosophy in there, ended up deciding to do my master's degree in bullying prevention and created a master's degree at Antioch New England University to do that. And got my master's degree in foundations of education, but really bullying prevention.
Okay. So let's move now. You're out speaking and you've got yourself a robust speaking career and training teachers. What was the first time you went, oh my God, that was a horrible mistake. I'll never do that again. The first big lesson you learned from a mistake.
So up until 1998, when I was presenting, I firmly believed that in order to help teachers, let's say, really understand the concepts I was teaching, that there needed to be some experiences in the training that would help them feel what kids might feel if they experienced certain things. And so, for example, I would have them role play bullying. And one of the teachers would be a student, one of them would be a teacher. I literally had them role play a bullying teacher. I'd seen teachers bully kids so many times. Well, that worked for me on a small scale, and it was really powerful. I did that kind of interactive teaching, hands-on things, everything. That was what I learned from my mentor, Fritz Bell. Well, then I got an audition. I was able to audition with a seminar company that was one of the primary and top-rated seminar companies for educators in the country. And I had an audience of 200 teachers in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And they say the teachers in Long Island are tough. Well, let me tell you, these teachers were really tough.
Yeah, the Steel City can be a bear.
When I had them do that role play, it pissed them off. And not only that, they were stuffed into a room that was too small for the number of people. They were adding chairs even when the room was already full. There was a Christmas concert going on in the room next to me that you could hear through the divider. There were teachers talking in the background and other teachers complaining to me. The teachers were talking. It was a disaster, a disaster. And I had, you know, the scores I got just, they slayed me with their evaluations and slayed me with the scores. And in order to make the mark, I had to have out of 7 points, I had to have a 6.5 average. Anything lower than that, you didn't get in with the seminar company. Okay. And I got like a 5.5. It was heartbreaking. They just tore me apart. And what I realized was I had to learn how to pander, in a sense, to the audience. And it's one of the reasons I stopped working with a seminar company, because after 20 years of doing so, which was what also helped me get my foundation, I was constantly coached, I constantly had to read evaluations, I constantly had to prove my game, and I constantly had to win over teachers in an audience who were sent to my training who wanted nothing to do with what I was teaching. And that made me a very, very good speaker, because I had to do well. I had to win them over. I had to take angry teachers and have them leave feeling good about what they were doing. So having that experience, now I can work pretty much any kind of audience pretty confidently. I'm sure there'll be times where I'll get a rough audience, but I've learned the lessons of how to deliver information in a way that people can accept it. And sometimes I think that politicians could use some of that.
that's my sale.
Most of them, I listen to them and I go, oh my gosh, you have no idea how to bring an audience along with you from where they're at. You know, it's just crazy, crazy, crazy.
So, all right, let me ask you a question. Now, you look back on your career, and this is one of my favorite questions I ask people. If you could look back and give yourself advice at the age of 16, and you could say, Susan, here's what you need to change, what advice would you give yourself?
Oh, goodness, at 16.
Yeah, assuming at 16 you would have listened to your adult self. What advice?
I don't know that I could have, if I might have said, you're enough. Okay. You're capable. And maybe let me do this. Okay. So when I was 16, I was very insecure. I still had my, you know, this passionate, bubbly personality. People called that flaky. And it didn't fit in. I was that odd duck. I was absolutely that odd duck in school. And so I had very, very little confidence. And I also had a really rough upbringing. So, you know, the wounds and the spears and the things that I took from growing up also didn't really help my confidence and my ability. Sure. I was scared to death to get in front of an audience at 16. We had to do it for classes, for English class. And I mean, I was like, oh my God, I can't do that. And part of it was because I can't memorize. I don't memorize anything. So anyway, the best way to give this is share an analogy. When I was 16 years old, I was going to a prom. And we didn't have money for me to go to the store and buy this gorgeous prom gown. My dad had started something with me when I was in the eighth grade. And he said, he bought me a sewing machine. And he said, I will buy you all the material you want, as long as you show me what you've created. Show me what you've created with the material I bought, I will buy you more material. So I had to make my prom gown. So my dad takes me to the fabric store. We're looking at satin. I loved the satin. And there was a satin material that had stars on it. And then it had the opposite material. So there was a pastel pink with white stars, and there was white with pastel pink stars. And that's the one I wanted. I wanted the pastel pink. And to my surprise, my father got angry. And he said, "Why do you want pastel pink?" I said, "I like it, Dad." He said, "Get this one." And he picked out red satin with white stars, and okay, white satin with red stars. So the dress was going to be, you know, the solid color, and the trim, the ruffle trim, was going to be the opposite color. And I said, "I don't want that, Dad. I don't want the red." And he gave me a lecture. He said, "You know what?" He said, "You need to learn how to stand out. You need to learn how to be, have the courage to stand out and be who you are. I'll buy you the red material. I am not buying you pastel pink. You are not going to fade into the woodwork." I'll never forget it. I still have the dress. I still have that dress hanging in my closet. It's, I tried to wash it and it turned, the white turned pink, but it's still there because.
Oh wait, so after all these years, you got your pink.
I got the pink. Yes, I did. I did. But you know, I think about that. And my dad was the one who encouraged me to go to college. My dad was the one who taught me to love books. And he taught me to love books so much. He loved books so much. That's why I started using Susan Gingras Fitzell, because my maiden name is Gingras, and I wanted to be able to hand my first book to my father with his name on it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So he could look at that book that his daughter wrote, Susan Gingras, and my married name, Fitzell.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yep.
So I guess listening to your dad would have been really good advice back then. And you sort of did.
Yes.
What advice would you give someone today if someone called you and said, "Hey, Susan, I want to go into the speaking business"? What advice would you give them?
I think there are two things that I would give them. One, hone your skill for speaking, you know, and practice, and read evaluations and make adjustments. However, I think the biggest mistake beginner speakers make that I have seen is they have something they're absolutely passionate about, they want to talk about, but it's not a topic people want to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like nobody was buying bullying prevention in 1994. In 1995, but they were buying character education. So I still did bullying prevention, but I wrapped it up and packaged it in character education. And I see a lot of people trying to start a speaking career. I think if you're seasoned and you've already had something established, you can probably pivot and come up with something really unique that nobody else is buying. I think Scott McCain may have done that with distinction. You know, he came up with distinction and then put his brand around that.
Right,
but he was already speaking before that. Right. You know, he was already seasoned, but especially brand new. I mean, they come to me, I've had this happen many times, and they say, "Oh, I really want to speak on now it sells mindfulness." They wanted to speak about mindfulness, you know, 20 years ago, nobody cared about mindfulness then. Can you wrap it up into something that's selling today? Do you know what people are paying for? What budget items do they need? What's, you know, it's like you've got to be able to use the right words in your proposal that tie into what their budget is or their grant is or whatever way they're paying for you. It has to fit that mission and that purpose. And
that's
I think a lot of speakers are very idealistic when they start.
Very
and they
good.
Don't do that homework.
That's awesome. And that is a very, well, that's true in all business.
Yeah.
You know, that's, I'm saying that people don't buy what they don't understand.
Exactly.
Yeah,
now let me say something, because there are people who know me that are probably listening to this and they're saying, "Well, Susan, you're selling neurodiversity and nobody knows what that is." But I'm strategic about it.
You're selling inclusiveness.
Yes.
Which sells.
Yes. And I'm using the language of neurodiversity because it's a very narrow niche. And at this stage of my career, I only want to work with the people who already have heard of it and know what it is, and therefore need me to move their initiative forward. I don't want to be breaking ground and trying to help some manager who has no clue what neurodiversity is. I mean, I don't want to have that person be my client. So I don't want to call it something generic and then just get anybody. That's not the audience I want. I know exactly who I want as my target audience, and that's why I'm sticking with neurodiversity in my language, even though I've been advised to use, more generic language from some of
Yes,
my peers.
but so at this point in your career, you are very comfortable preaching to the choir. You
Preaching to
don't.
the people who are forward-thinking.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to build your own church. You already know you can find the people that are coming to the church.
Yes,
Yeah.
and they're doing that. What's really fascinating to me is that I haven't been able to do any outreach in a year. I haven't done any new writing in a year because I've had some health issues to deal with, and just my schedule has been so crazy busy. Yet I am still on a weekly basis getting fresh leads for people who are interested in having me work with them on neurodiversity. And of
Well,
course, I've got a full plate with what I've been building for 20 years in education.
that's beautiful. Now, let me ask you this. I know you said you're working on a book, but what new is on your whiteboard or your vision board? What's new in the future for you? What is it you're looking to do that's different? Anything?
It's not 100% new. Does it have to be work related?
I don't, yeah, no, I don't care. I just want to know what is it you want to do that's new?
I want to keep doing ballroom dancing and competing with it.
That's
Yeah,
beautiful.
that's
Yeah.
new to me. It's only I did it for a year, then I had to stop for this last year, and now I'm starting with a new school tonight, a
Okay.
new dance pro in a new school. And for me, the new thing is maybe this work less, because I have been a workaholic for many, many, many years, most of my life, and work less and really enjoy the things I love more. And
Good
I've
for you.
always loved to dance. So that's one of the new things that I'm going to be doing
And
going
if your
forward.
dance partner fails you, you can throw them to the mat and use martial arts, right?
There you go.
There you
Yes.
go. Susan, if anyone in Cigar Peg is looking to talk to you or find out more about you, what's the best way to reach out and find you?
They can just email me at my email address, which is susan@susanfitzell.com.
You got it. Good.
Real
And
easy, but yeah.
so let me
That's
ask you the.
the private one. That's not the one to get spam
Okay.
emails.
So that's the one where they can actually get you and not get
Yes,
all
that's a
the.
special one. It's very, yeah. I only give it to certain people, so I'll give it to Cigar Peg people.
There you go. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we go? Any advice you'd like to give or closing remark?
What's coming to me now is so many of us are looking forward to the next years of our lives, however many or few that might be. And a lot of us are, and I do this too sometimes, comparing ourselves with others and being hard on ourselves. Oh, we didn't do enough of this, or we didn't do enough of that, or we didn't make enough cold calls. And I would say the advice I would say is take stock of what you have accomplished. I've not done that nearly enough in my life and not appreciated. I mean, I've written over 16 books, and somebody else will go, "Oh my gosh, you've written 16 books." And I go, "Yeah, so." And I think that that's something that we all need to appreciate more is what we have accomplished and what we have done and the relationships we have built, instead of always looking for more and more and more.
Bravo. That's how we are going to end. And thank you for joining us, Susan, in the Cigar Lounge. And let me just say, I will stay online with you after the recording stops to make sure I don't lose this recording. Thank you all. Bye.